A messy heap of 8 mini VHS tapes and 8 mini DVDs slimmed down to 3 standard DVDs. My 15-minute sufferings showed me how much I could accomplish when I did a manageable amount of work on a regular basis. As Anthony Trollope, the preternaturally prolific novelist who also managed to revolutionize the British Postal Service, observed, "A small daily task, if it be really daily, will beat the labors of a spasmodic Hercules." This task had seemed so intimidating, but by faithfully doing a small bit at a time, I'd managed to achieve something large. And really, it hadn't been very difficult once I finally started. Go on monthly adventures with Jamie. Researchers into psychology have long sought to devise the most comprehensive, elegant framework to capture the mystery of personality. And in recent years, the Big Five model has emerged as the most useful. It measures personality according to 5 factors. 1. Openness to experience, breadth of mental associations. 2. Conscientiousness, response to inhibition, self-control, planning. 3. Extroversion, response to reward. 4. Agreeableness, regard for others. 5. Neuroticism, response to threat. When put in that order, the 5 factors spell out the helpful mnemonic OCEAN, O-C-E-A-N. When I took the Newcastle Personality Assessor Test to measure myself according to these 5 factors, I scored as very conscientious, which didn't surprise me. I always hand in my work on time. I go to the gym fairly often. I resist most treats. I pay bills promptly. My children always get their vaccinations. Though for some reason, I've never managed to floss regularly. In fact, my conscientiousness is one of my favorite things about myself. Jamie is very conscientious too. His conscientiousness isn't always triggered by the tasks that I wish he'd tackle. For instance, picking up phone messages doesn't make his list, but about things that really matter, he's utterly reliable. A wonderful quality in a spouse. Because we share this inclination, we respect it in each other. I don't tell him to get off his laptop, and he doesn't protest if I say, "I need to go to the library for a few hours on Saturday." We both hate to be late, so we spend a lot of time waiting for airplanes to begin to board or for movies to start. Conscientiousness makes many things in life easier, and research even suggests that this trait may be a key factor in longevity. But there's a downside to this conscientiousness. Jamie and I can't turn it on and off. A vigilant conscience is a rough taskmaster. As a couple, we work hard and don't goof around much. We almost never drink. We spend a lot of time on the computer. We don't take much vacation. We rarely stray from our neighborhood or vary our routine. Although this way of life generally suits us, I wondered if Jamie and I should have a little more fun together. For just as I needed to be wary of my urge to simplify, I also needed to guard against becoming too abstemious, too wed to my productive routines. I didn't want to go to sleep at 10 p.m. every night. I now defend myself from temperance as I used to do against voluptuousness, Montaigne admitted. Wisdom has its excesses and has no less need of moderation than folly. Or, as I told myself, do nothing in excess, not even moderation. Although research shows that novelty and challenge boost happiness, when I started my study of happiness, I was convinced that this wasn't true for me. For me, I believed, familiarity and mastery were keys to happiness. But when I pushed myself, I discovered, no. Even for someone like me, novelty and challenge serve as huge engines of happiness. It's a happiness paradox. Control and mastery bring happiness, so do surprises, novelty, and challenge. In fact, positive events make us happier when they're not predictable, because the surprise makes the experience more intense. In the case of couples, novelty and excitement stimulate the brain chemicals that are present during courtship. Studies show that doing something exciting, something a couple doesn't usually do, like biking, gives a bigger romantic boost than doing something pleasant, like going to a movie. But even small steps, such as going to new restaurants or seeing different sets of friends, can help lift marital happiness. Nevertheless, Jamie and I both experienced a lot of novelty and challenge in our work. Sometimes, too much novelty and challenge. Would we be happier if our marriage was a refuge of comfort, calm, and order? Or should we be more adventurous? On a free night, were we better off reading in bed and going to sleep early, which is what we usually felt like doing, or pushing ourselves to go to a cooking class? Well, the studies were quite clear. We'd be happier if we did new things. And I wanted to be more active in making fun plans. Almost always, it was Jamie who suggested that we take a trip, see a movie, or even go out for frozen yogurt. Also, as much as we loved to be with Eliza and Eleanor, it would be nice to have more adult time. In her book, 168 Hours, You Have More Time Than You Think, Laura Vanderkam points out that in general, married people with children tend to spend less time with each other alone than they did in the past. In 1975, they clocked 12.4 hours each week. By 2000, it was 9.1 hours. Although I recognize the irony, I decided that we needed to work harder at play. I would try to schedule time for us to be spontaneous. But how? My weekly adventures with Eliza gave me an idea. Maybe Jamie and I could do something like that. As I'd done with a resolution to give warm greetings and farewells, I decided to flout my sixth splendid truth. The only person I can change is myself. For the second time, I would break that truth to try to convince Jamie to adopt a resolution with me. I raised the issue with Jamie one night. "You know how Eliza and I have been doing our weekly adventures?" I asked as we walked down the street to our apartment. He nodded. "That's a really nice thing. I'm glad you're doing it. Where did you go yesterday?" "We went to see an exhibit of children's book illustrations. Lots of fun. Actually, I was thinking that you and I could do something along those lines. Not once a week, that's too often. But how about planning an adventure for the two of us once a month?" "What do you want to do?" he asked. "Go to the circus?" "Well, we could walk around some unfamiliar part of town. We both love doing that. We could go to the Apple store and take an iPad class. We could go to a great bookstore." "Huh," was his only response. I let the issue drop. I knew that sometimes it was helpful to introduce an idea to Jamie, let it sink in, then raise it another day instead of bringing it up at 30-minute intervals, as I'm inclined to do. I waited a few weeks. Then, when we were waiting for our turn to go into Eleanor's parent-teacher conference, I raised the issue again. "What about the monthly adventures?" I asked. "Do you want to give that a try?" Jamie cocked his head thoughtfully, then bent over his phone without answering. I bit my tongue. "He's deliberately being rude," I thought. "How many times have I told him how much I hate it when he doesn't answer me?" Then the resolution to make the positive argument flashed through my mind, and I reminded myself, "He's not deliberately being rude." And I realized he wasn't. Not deliberately. Again, I let some weeks pass, then made one final attempt. We'd told Eliza and Eleanor that we would let them stay home without a grown-up for the first time, another bittersweet milestone, so we ran errands for an hour. On our way home, I said, "So what about the monthly adventures? What do you think?" "What monthly adventures?" Jamie asked. "You know," I said in a deliberately calm voice, "like the weekly adventures I do with Eliza, some plan for you and me once a month." "It sounds fun, but so many things are coming up," Jamie sighed. "In theory, I'd like to do it, but I just don't think it would stay on the calendar." "Is that okay?" He put his arm around me. "It's okay," I reassured him. "I understand how you feel." I did understand, and I wasn't going to press the issue further. The sixth splendid truth was indeed true. In the end, I can make resolutions only for myself. As Elizabeth says of creative projects, "You want volunteers, not recruits." I didn't want to create an occasion for nagging, rescheduling, and resentment between us. And to be honest, I was a bit relieved by Jamie's reluctance to adopt this resolution. Was it really a good idea to add another item to our already hectic schedules? "My husband and I had a weekly date night for years," a friend told me, But lately, all we did on those nights was argue. Now we set aside that night to relax at home with our daughter, and we go to bed early. If we fight, at least we're not paying a babysitter. Jamie and I were in the rush hour of life, and we were busy and tired. Thanks mostly to Jamie's efforts, we did make time to go to movies, just the two of us, and to have the occasional dinner with friends. If adding a monthly adventure felt like a burden instead of a treat, we wouldn't enjoy it. Maybe in a few years, I'd raise the idea again. Around the same time, at the end of January, my emotional energy flagged. I felt trapped in a kind of Groundhog Day of happiness. The timing was fitting, given that the actual Groundhog Day was approaching. When I looked back at my resolutions charts from the previous months, I saw rows of X's on certain pages. The same resolutions defeated me over and over. I wasn't making much progress. I was tired of the persistent dissatisfaction of the shelf-by-shelf exercise. Nothing stayed done. I cleared a shelf, and a few weeks later, it was covered with another mess. I replaced one light bulb, then another bulb burned out. I resented having to get my hair cut again. Even worse than these repeated dreary tasks were my faults, which never seemed to improve. I made the same resolutions month after month, and I kept backsliding on some of the most important ones over and over. I was weary of myself, my broken promises to do better, my small-minded grudges, my wearisome fears, my narrow preoccupations. I spoke sharply to my daughters. I still dreaded driving. I didn't appreciate the present moment. Disagreeable aspects of myself, even those I usually accepted without much unhappiness, nagged at me. My hair twisting, for instance. I'd been twisting my red hair my whole life. Once I'd expected to outgrow the habit, but now I know I never will. I wouldn't be bothered by my hair twisting, except that I break off my hair. That's the fun part. And though other people probably don't notice, the sight of that ragged line of broken hair had started to rankle. Also, my bad temper kept flaring up. One morning, I somehow set off a muscle spasm when I turned my head at the kitchen sink. It hurt like crazy, and I had a busy day ahead of me. As was his custom, Jamie listened to me describe the pain for a few minutes, then adopted an attitude of, well, let's not let this affect our day. Eliza announced, I'm leaving now, and we all took a moment to give her a warm farewell. Then I said to Jamie, you make sure Eleanor gets dressed. I need to take something for the pain. 10 minutes later, Jamie stepped out of Eleanor's room to give me a goodbye kiss. I gotta go. Is Eleanor already dressed? I asked in surprise. She said she's gonna get dressed herself. I glanced into her room. Eleanor sat naked on the floor, obviously sulking. That's getting her dressed? I've got to get to the office. I gave Jamie the meanest possible look of disdain and fury. Then go, I snarled. He went. For the rest of the day, that snarl bothered me. My neck hurt, I felt justified in my anger toward Jamie, and yet my reaction made everything worse. I wanted to apologize, but I thought Jamie should apologize to me, and he didn't. We had pleasant, normal interactions that night, but I felt terrible. It took a tremendous effort, but I said, hey, about this morning, about that mean face I made, I'm sorry. I was annoyed, but that wasn't necessary. Pleased with my nobility, I gave him a hug and a kiss. Oh, that's okay, Jamie said, as if he hadn't given my mean face or his own lapse a second thought. Which made me angry all over again. He hadn't even noticed my mean face or remembered why he so richly deserved it. I brooded fruitlessly over the thought that even when I did behave myself or managed to keep a difficult resolution, I rarely got the gold stars I craved. Even Saintly Therese dryly admitted that she was bothered by people's annoying tendency to ignore good behavior and pounce on bad behavior. I noticed this. When one performs her duty, never excusing herself, no one knows it. On the contrary, imperfections appear immediately. But couldn't I behave better for myself? And as much as I worked to be more mindful, I so often fell into my absent-minded, distracted, not-here-now ways. For example, One of my oldest friends was coming to town from Switzerland, and for weeks we'd planned that she'd come over for dinner with her two sons, and I completely forgot. I didn't remember until a buzz came from the front door, and I heard Jamie ask, puzzled, "Nancy who?" "Nancy! It's Nancy and her sons!" I jumped up and frantically started tidying up. "They're here for dinner." "Now?" Jamie said in disbelief. "Yes, I forgot. They're here for dinner. Buzz them in." Nancy and her sons came upstairs. We ordered pizza, and we had a lovely evening. Nancy was exceptionally nice about my lapse, and Jamie thought it was hilarious. But despite the fun of the evening, I remained agitated. How could I have forgotten something like this? One of my clearest memories of childhood was walking to the library with Nancy when we were 10 years old. She was too important to forget. Could I remember nothing without checking my calendar every few hours? Not only did I feel disheartened by my own limitations, but I also felt hunted by the very subject of happiness. No matter how unrelated a task seemed to be, it always ended up instructing me. I bought a new Subway Metro card, and when I idly glanced down at it, spotted a happiness quotation from Emerson. "Life is a train of moods like a string of beads, and as we pass through them, they prove to be many-colored lenses which paint the world their own hue, and each shows only what lies in its own focus." Instead of feeling charmed by finding this apt happiness quotation on such a modest object, I felt badgered by constant reminders to behave myself and mindfully shape my experience. I wasn't tired of the subject of happiness, and I didn't feel pressure to be happy all the time. But I was weary of my own voice, my own ways of thinking. Just the way that, left to my own devices, I'd buy the same pieces of clothing over and over, a gray V-neck sweater, a stretchy orange hoodie, a black cardigan, I felt my thinking falling into the same worn grooves. I hauled out my usual bag of happiness cures. I went to sleep earlier. I reread The Railway Children. I answered some long postponed emails. I took some cute pictures of Eliza and Eleanor. I gave everyone an especially warm greeting and farewell. One of my resolutions is to forget about results and to take notes without a purpose. So I gave myself a work break to write a list of ways I violate standard happiness advice. Jamie and I have a TV in our bedroom, and it just got bigger. We allow Eliza to use the computer in her bedroom without supervision. I make the girls' beds in the morning instead of insisting that they do it. I never ask my family questions like, "Tell me three good things that happened during your day." I never have date nights with Jamie. I don't make the girls write thank you notes. Whenever possible, I read while I eat. Jamie and I listen to All News Radio all night long. I refuse to try meditation. During this low time, at lunch with a bookish British friend, we started talking about what we read to cheer ourselves up. I was looking for suggestions for some further bibliotherapy. "I always reach for Samuel Johnson," he said. "Really? Me too." "Well, either Johnson or children's literature," I answered, delighted to discover a fellow devotee of Dr. Johnson. "I didn't know you loved Johnson." "Oh, yes. I've read all his works many times. Also biographies and biographies of John Boswell, too." "I love Johnson. I can't get enough. And he's one of my most important models as a writer." "You're writing a dictionary?" "Hardly. But his Rambler essays are the 18th century equivalent of posting to a blog. Johnson wrote them twice a week, finished them fast, on whatever topic he wanted, and I write about the same kinds of things." "But Johnson wrote about such weighty subjects." "He wrote about human nature, and that's what interests me," I said, "and the practice of everyday life. Really, I'm a moral essayist, though I'd never admit that in public. It sounds so boring and preachy." "It does sound a bit old-fashioned," he said, laughing. Then we started trading our favorite Johnson lines. "I want to run home right now and reread Boswell's Life of Johnson," I declared as we stood up to leave. "Me too, but back to the office." He went to the office, but I did go home and immediately start to reread The Life of Samuel Johnson, which really did make me feel better. It was comforting to recall that great souls such as Samuel Johnson, Benjamin Franklin, Leo Tolstoy, and Saint Therese made and remade the same resolutions throughout their lives. As Johnson admitted to Boswell, "Sir, are you so grossly ignorant of human nature as not to know that a man may be very sincere in good principles without having good practice?" "My principles were sound. My practice would improve with practice." And the ironic thing? That afternoon, after all our fuss about whether to push Eliza to take piano lessons, she walked into the kitchen and announced, "I'd like to learn to play the guitar." "Really? Well, sure," I said. The month of February. Body. Experience the experience. Happiness, knowledge, not in another place, but this place. Not for another hour, but this hour. Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass, A Song for Occupations. Resolutions? Embrace good smells. Ask for a knock, give a knock. Celebrate holiday breakfasts. Jump. Try acupuncture. Every time I step through the door to my apartment, I'm hit by the particular sense of home created by everything from the scents I encounter to the way I'm greeted by my family to the level of mess I confront. Home is a state of mind, but it's also a physical experience. Because happiness can seem very abstract and transcendent, for the month of February, I wanted to anchor my thoughts about happiness in the reality of my body. Experience the experience, I frequently admonish myself. The more I thought about happiness, the more convinced I became of the value of the concrete. Airy recommendations such as find ways to bounce back, love yourself, or be optimistic struck me as unhelpfully vague. Although such suggestions would certainly boost happiness, I found it easier to follow resolutions that could clearly be evaluated, such as sing in the morning, keep a one-sentence journal, or make the positive argument. Focusing on my body was a way to keep my resolutions specific and tangible. Also, things that I experienced physically held a special power. After dinner one evening, as I helped Eleanor decorate a school Valentine's box with heart stickers, silver glitter, and fancy lettering, it struck me that my children make me happy, in part, because they encourage me to engage more deeply with the physical world. Left to my own instincts, I'd drift absentmindedly through the apartment, reading, writing, and eating cereal for dinner every night. Eliza's enjoyment of our soft fleece blanket, Eleanor's delight in the vanishing sweetness of cotton candy, the textures and colors of the Play-Doh, scented markers, and velvety pipe cleaners left scattered around the kitchen. With my daughters, I've become much more alive to these pleasures and experiences of daily life. In my last happiness project, I'd made body-related resolutions such as go to sleep earlier, exercise better, and act more energetic, and I'd felt a dramatic spike in my happiness and energy. Similarly, this month, I'd focus on physical influences on happiness. I plan to tap into the powers of my senses of smell and hearing by resolving to embrace good smells and ask for a knock, give a knock. With a resolution to celebrate holiday breakfasts, I hope to turn these occasional mealtimes into an engine of happiness. To enhance my general sense of physical energy and well-being, I resolve to jump, quite literally, jump up and down, and to try acupuncture. These body-centric resolutions had solid studies to back them up, and I read this evidence with great interest. Nevertheless, despite my inexhaustible appetite for happiness-related science, I've become less trusting of its conclusions. First, in the time I've been following the research, I've witnessed big swings in scientific conclusions as well as conflicting results. Did exercise actually make people happier, or were happier people merely more likely to exercise? Second, I've seen arguments that struck me as highly questionable. According to some happiness researchers, children don't make parents happier. However, in my experience, and I think most parents would agree, children are indeed a significant source of happiness. Nowadays, I read the science in much the same way that I read novels, philosophy, and biographies, to expose myself to new ideas and new perspectives on happiness. Science can be tremendously illuminating, especially when it disproves conventional wisdom or suggests new factors to consider. But I've grown careful to test those ideas against my own experience, which admittedly imposes a different limitation on my thinking. Boswell reports that when he remarked to Johnson that it was impossible to refute Bishop Berkeley's argument against the existence of matter, Johnson indignantly kicked a large stone and answered, "I refute it thus. In my experience, did exercise contribute to happiness? Absolutely. In my view, did my children contribute to my happiness? Yes, indeed. I refute it thus." As I considered the aims for February, the month of body, I wanted to pay special attention to the experiences that I was actually experiencing, not unthinkingly to accept other people's theories or arguments, but instead to stay mindful of what I actually found to be true for me. Embrace good smells. Mindfulness is an indispensable virtue for happiness, which is unfortunate because I'm not a mindful person. As I try to be more mindful of the little flashes of happiness or unhappiness I experienced during my day, I noticed that many subtle things influenced me, some of which I barely consciously registered. One surprising influence? My sense of smell. It was Eleanor who led me to concentrate on this area. She has a real nose and often reacts with delight or disgust to a smell that I've hardly noticed. I remember years ago, when I was pushing her stroller up Lexington Avenue, she turned her tiny face to me and asked in wonderment, "Mommy, what's that good smell?" She looked rapturous at the familiar smell of that staple of New York City streets, a Nuts for Nuts cart selling honey roasted nuts. I never gave those carts a second thought, but she was right. The nuts smelled marvelous. On the other hand, for years, she cried every time we put her in a car because she hated the smell so much, and she flatly refused to go into the stinky penguin house at the Central Park Zoo. Reflecting on Eleanor's reactions made me curious about the power of scents, and my reading turned up many interesting facts. I was surprised to learn that, unlike taste, the human response to smells is learned, not innate. That is, nothing smells good, roses, or bad, rotten meat, until we learn that it's a good smell or a bad smell. The average person can recognize and remember about 10,000 odors. After exposure to a particular smell, we adapt to it and must take several minutes away from it to detect it again. Although we often discount the importance of the sense of smell, people who suffer from anosmia, loss of the sense of smell, often become depressed. They lose interest in food and sex, have difficulty sleeping, and feel disconnected from others. Most interesting to me, my happiness affects my sense of smell and vice versa. A person in a good mood perceives a neutral odor, such as rubbing alcohol, as more pleasant than does a person in a bad mood and doesn't become as annoyed by bad smells. At the same time, smelling an enjoyable odor can help alleviate anxiety and increase tolerance for pain. A particular scent can bring back memories with tremendous intensity. In the most famous example, Marcel Proust recalled long-forgotten memories when he smelled and tasted a madeleine soaked in linden tea. In fact, these kinds of involuntary and vivid rushes of memory evoked by the senses are called Proustian memories. "Wherever I am in the world," wrote Jorge Luis Borges, "all I need is the smell of eucalyptus to recover that lost world of Adrogué, which today no doubt exists only in my memory. I love the smell of popcorn, which makes me think of my mother, and the smell of crayons, which makes me think of childhood." A friend mentioned her recent experience with a Proustian memory. "On my way to work, I walked by a guy wearing Dracar Noir, the cologne my ex-boyfriend used to wear. It ruined my whole morning." Once I appreciated the power of smell to influence my emotions and its importance to my sense of vitality and enjoyment, I resolved to embrace good smells. To start, I was intrigued by a reference I'd seen in Rachel Herz's fascinating book, The Scent of Desire, where Herz mentioned the naturalistic, unusual scents created by Demeter fragrance. I looked up Demeter fragrance online and was staggered by its offerings. Bamboo, clean windows, dust, bourbon, snow, grass, laundromat, lilac, frozen pond, gardenia, New Zealand, steam room. At first I thought wistfully, I wish I could smell some of these myself. Then I realized I could. As an underbuyer, I have to remind myself that, yes, I can buy things. I knew the girls would love the smells, too. I started putting scents in my online shopping cart. Bonfire, pure soap, salt air. Bulgarian rose, because I love the smell of roses, and roses are an auspicious motif of my happiness project. And I had to order paperback. But earthworm? My curiosity wasn't strong enough to entice me to buy that one. As with Bertie Bott's Every Flavor Beans, it was important to make my choices carefully. One Saturday, the box arrived from Demeter. "Come here," I called to Eliza and Eleanor. "Check out all these smells." We made a guessing game out of testing the different sprays. Before we made it through all the scents, however, we had to stop because Eleanor had developed a bad headache. She never complained about headaches, so I was a little worried until I realized Eleanor has a hypersensitive sense of smell. She'd just been hit with several powerful odors in an hour. No wonder she had a headache. I'd always disdained air fresheners, but these scents made me an enthusiast. My office smelled like Christmas tree. And while I couldn't light a bonfire in the hallway, now I could enjoy that exciting autumn smell wherever I wanted it. I loved my bottles from Demeter, but what should I do with them? It seemed a shame to put them away in a back closet, and it felt like clutter. Then I decided I'd make a shrine to scent. I cleared off a shelf on a convenient bookcase and set out the bottles. I stood back to judge the effect and wasn't impressed. Then I remembered a secret of adulthood. Everything looks better arranged on a tray. I pulled a silver tray from a cabinet, set it on the shelf, and arranged the bottles nicely. Now that looked like a shrine to scent. Plus, I got an added jolt of satisfaction from figuring out a way to deploy a lovely, little-used tray. "But these are fake smells," a friend protested when I proudly showed off my display. "It's just a bunch of chemicals." This alleged fakeness didn't bother me, but I did want to pay more attention to the pleasant smells that naturally filled my day. Research shows that paying attention to smells actually enhances our ability to perceive them. If we don't attend to them, they drift off unnoticed. I prompted myself to pay attention when I covered Eleanor with baby lotion, which is one of my very favorite smells, the Hawaiian coconut and orchid smell of Eliza's latest shampoo, the starchy masculine smell of Jamie's shirts, the particular scent of our building's lobby. A friend had once pointed out, the lobby of your building has a very noticeable smell. It's not a bad smell, but it's distinctive. In the middle of winter, I couldn't stop to smell the roses, but I could take a moment to bury my face in a pile of towels to enjoy that hot, clean fragrance as they came from the dryer. I was mystified by the fact that every hardware store, large or small, has that same hardware store smell, and I breathed it in deeply every time I visited. How else to add good smells to my life? Keeping flowers in the apartment would be a wonderful source of natural scents, but as an underbuyer, I would never buy them. I did pick up some lavender sachets for my drawers, a very un-underbuyer, unsimplifying thing to do. I'd always enjoyed perfume, but I'd stopped wearing it much. I knew that perfume bothered some people. When I pulled out my perfume bottles, I loved the powerful scent of L'Artisan Parfumer's Tea Rose, the perfume I wore my senior year in college, but I discovered that my Penhaligon Lily of the Valley had lost its smell. I'd saved it too long. Lovely stationery, new white t-shirts, those wonderful Japanese paper plates my mother gave me. Why was I saving them? I should spend out, use things up, enjoy them for their purpose. I should wear my perfume. After all, I didn't work in an office with a lot of other people or ride in crowded elevators. No one would be bothered by it, and I would love it. I even started putting on perfume before I went to bed. Few pleasures, I reflected, had the simplicity of a lovely scent. As I rushed through the kitchen, I could pause for a moment to inhale the sharp, sweet smell of a grapefruit. It didn't cost anything, didn't require anyone else's cooperation, didn't have any calories, and didn't take any planning or time to enjoy. It was a quick hit of an innocent indulgence. Also, I used scent as a cue to experience the experience, to be alive to the present moment and to my memories. How I wish I could smell again the baked, woody, spicy fragrance of the attic of my parents' old house. On a less elevated note, at the same time that I wanted to appreciate good smells more, I looked for ways to eliminate bad odors. Our dishwasher had a funny smell. Time to add more jet dry. Our garbage can often had a bad smell. I sprayed it with pure soap. And although ordering a bottle of Demeter's Wet Garden was more enjoyable than running an errand, it was definitely time to replace my running shoes. Ask for a knock, give a knock. Embrace Good Smells was a resolution aimed at helping me tune in to a bodily pleasure in my everyday routine. But in addition to adding more feeling good, I wanted to eliminate some feeling bad. I'd noticed that I often spoke harshly when Jamie, Eliza, or Eleanor interrupted me while I was reading or working. I hated being wrenched out of a thought or delayed in the middle of a task. In particular, I tended to talk in a mean voice, as Eliza put it, when Eliza or Eleanor came into my office when I was working. Instead of responding nicely, I snarled, which made everyone feel bad. At the neighborhood library where I often worked, or at the various coffee shops I haunted, I had a delicious feeling of solitude and absorption, because it's not being alone that matters, it's not being interrupted. As a person who dislikes being interrupted, I'm lucky to work by myself. Whenever I've worked in an office, interruptions were constant. Research suggests that a person may need at least 15 minutes to regain focus after even a quick break in concentration, and when people are interrupted, they work faster to make up for lost time, and this hurrying makes them feel frustrated and harried. I thought of St. Teresa's example. To maintain her composure in the face of constant interruption, she reminded herself, "For the love of God and my sisters, so charitable toward me, I take care to appear happy, and especially to be so." So how could I appear happy, and more important, to be so, while being interrupted by my family? One of my 12 personal commandments is to identify the problem. I'm often surprised by how effective this is. Instead of thoughtlessly accepting a situation, I ask myself, what's the problem? And often, by forcing myself to understand the exact nature of the problem, I identify a solution. I'd been snapping at my daughters when they came into my office for a couple of years, when I finally asked myself, what's the problem? When my daughters interrupt me when I'm writing in my office, I snap at them. Why do I snap? Because I get annoyed when my concentration is broken without warning. Why don't I tell them not to come to my office? I like to have them come to my office. I just react badly for a moment when they break my focus. And suddenly I saw the solution. Beautiful in its simplicity. The girls should knock. A mother more vigilant about manners surely would have insisted that they knock from the start, but announcing that rule had never crossed my mind. I decided to propose my strategy the next morning. Yes, it meant another questionable attempt to assign a resolution to someone else, but I wanted to give this a try. "Listen," I proposed to them at breakfast, "I know it bothers you when I talk to you in a mean voice when you come up to my office to talk to me. And I'm sorry that I do it, but I can't seem to stop. And I really do like it when you come to talk to me. So let's try something. When you want to talk to me, knock first. Maybe that will help me react in a different way." "What if we forget?" they asked in unison. "Just try to remember. Let's see if it makes a difference." To my surprise, both girls and even Jamie adopted the habit immediately. Eleanor, in particular, was intrigued with this innovation. Sometimes, after she'd knocked and I sang out in honeyed tones, "Come in," she'd ask hopefully, "Were you going to say something in a mean voice if I didn't knock?" Getting this knock made an astonishing difference in my day. Somehow, that brief warning and act of courtesy allowed me to change the way I answered, which gave all of us a happiness boost. I thought more about interruptions and knocking when I learned about bids. It struck me that perhaps Jamie needed a different kind of knock from me. In his book, The Relationship Cure, relationship expert John Gottman emphasizes the importance of responding to bids. When someone makes an attempt to connect with a touch, question, gesture, comment, or look, we should answer with a comment, a laugh, or some kind of acknowledgement. To be attentive and playful is best. To be non-responsive, critical, or sarcastic is hurtful. His studies suggested that the more Jamie and I responded to each other's bids for attention, the stronger our marriage would be. Happily married people make more bids per hour than do less happily married people, and they ignore far fewer bids. Happily married men ignore wives' bids 19% of the time, wives 14% of the time. In unhappy marriages, husbands ignore wives' bids 82% of the time, wives 50% of the time. Studies suggest that when parents don't acknowledge children's bids, the children may have trouble developing social skills, suffer academically, and have more health problems. People may respond positively or negatively to a bid, or they may respond with what Gottman calls a turning away, when a person ignores a bid altogether. A turning away can take the form of a non-response, "How was work today?" met with no response, or an unrelated response, "How was work today?" met with, "Did you call the plumber?" Gottman points out that although sometimes people intentionally ignore a bid, more often they don't respond because they're preoccupied. Reading, watching TV, sending an email, hurrying to get something done. Nevertheless, the person making the failed bid feels diminished and frustrated when the bid is ignored. I was very familiar with this situation. Jamie often ignores my bids. Not out of a desire to be intentionally rude, but just because. Too often, he didn't respond when I made a comment, and as the studies predicted, his non-responses made me feel ignored and angry. I'd talked to Jamie about this behavior before I'd known about the terminology of bids. Usually, I tried to ignore it for a while, then explode at some point. "It's so rude not to answer. Please don't ignore what I'm saying." I knew he wasn't intentionally ignoring my bids, and he'd improved over time. But still, his habit got on my nerves. I fought the urge to chase him around the apartment while reading bits aloud from the Gottman book. I thought yet again of my sixth splendid truth. The only person I can change is myself. What could I do to change my habits that would help Jamie to change his habits? Getting a knock had helped me control my responses, so I decided to see if I could give Jamie a metaphorical knock to help him be more responsive. When I wanted him to respond thoughtfully to a particular bid, I told him so outright. "Hey, can you put that down?" I asked, pointing to his phone the next time I wanted his full attention. "It would help me to talk something over with you." "Okay," he said, continuing to scroll through his messages. "No, really, I want you to listen." I reached over and tapped on his phone screen. My version of a knock. He put down his phone and assumed a patient expression. "Sure, what's up?" "Someone wrote something very dismissive on my blog. Not vicious, but critical." "And?" "It's not a big deal, I know, but it has me feeling very agitated." "What did this person say?" "I'll read it to you," I said, opening my laptop. I was given Gretchen Rubin's book, The Happiness Project. I'm afraid I am going to be harsh. It seems to me that she just wants to read or write all day, and she keeps inventing projects that give her a valid reason to do so while calling it work. These projects allow her to draw attention to herself and invite praise, and are done at the expense of her immediate family, with whom she readily admits she is often angry or resentful because they interrupt her work. She also thinks a conversation is boring when it is not about her. For me, most of the book was stating the obvious, and her whole blog is immature and irritating. But then, I am 56 years old. That's it? Jamie asked. He looked amused. About 1 million people have written nice things on your blog. Just ignore it. Well, the negativity bias means that negative interactions affect us much more strongly than positive interactions. I know I shouldn't let one person's comments upset me, but I feel under attack. Well, remember, this is what you want. You want to put your ideas out there in public and hear people's reactions. Not everyone is going to like what you do. You're right, I admitted, brightening up at this view of the situation. It's true. I always remind myself, a strong voice repels as well as attracts. Well, you know what camp this person is from. Right, I looked back at the paragraph. So you don't find me immature and irritating? Not most of the time. He smiled and flipped my laptop shut. Really, don't worry about it. Our conversation put my mind at ease, mostly. And because I'd warned Jamie that the issue was important to me, not just a typical background conversation, he'd responded more appropriately. At the same time, as I started to focus on the issue of Jamie's response to my bids, I had to admit that I could do a much better job of acknowledging his bids. Murmuring, with my eyes glued to the page wasn't the way to foster intimacy and affection. Celebrate holiday breakfasts. Over coffee, when a friend asked what I was working on, I gave a quick sketch of some of my happiness project resolutions related to home. What am I leaving out? I asked. I'm always looking for suggestions. Pets, she said. You should get a dog. Your girls would love it. Well, I hesitated. I don't think that our building permits pets. The truth is, I didn't want any pets. Keep it simple. But she was right. Studies suggest that pets make people happier and even healthier. Almost 60% of American homes include a pet, usually a cat or dog, and pets can have an enormous influence on a household's atmosphere. Adam, my brother-in-law, received several condolence cards when his cat Paco died. Ah, too bad. Then what about meals? She suggested. Meals are incredibly important to a happy home life. What are you doing in that area? Meals? I repeated. I haven't thought much about meals. Food is a critically important part of life, of course. But in truth, I couldn't muster much enthusiasm for meal-related resolutions. You really should work on mealtime, she said. After all, don't studies show that when families eat meals together, the kids do better in school, behave better, don't do drugs, all that? You can't overlook meals. There must be ways to use them to boost gratitude, bring everyone closer together. You're right. I'll give it some thought, I promised, without much conviction. I felt guilty for not being more interested. Then I realized, no. This was my happiness project, and I didn't feel a pressing desire to think about meals. That's what I decided, until Valentine's Day reminded me of a wonderful idea for a family mealtime tradition. For me, one of the most important aspects of home is the celebration of traditions. Family traditions mark time in a happy way and give a sense both of anticipation and continuity. Research shows that traditions, routines, and rituals boost physical and emotional health. And they're fun. I love traditions, but I dislike hassle. I could barely keep up with the big traditions we already celebrated, not to mention the demands of ordinary life. For instance, Eleanor's 6th birthday was in February, and just making the arrangements for her little party absorbed a remarkable amount of energy and time. Was there a way to incorporate more of the fun of traditions in a way that was meaningful yet painless? I wanted to keep it simple, but not too simple. Just in time for Valentine's Day, I recalled a conversation I'd had a year before when I happened to stop by the house of a friend on February 14th. What's all this? I asked as I walked in. Her dining room table was ablaze in pink and red. Sorry about the mess. Today's Valentine's Day, so we had a holiday breakfast. What's that? Well, with 4 kids, so far apart in age, with everyone's schedule, it's tough to have a special dinner together. So for minor holidays, I make a holiday breakfast. I looked more closely at the table. Her decorations were simple but festive, with heart-shaped placemats, red candles, and some conversation heart candies. What a fantastic idea, I told her. I love it. She'd seemed a bit defensive about it, but she warmed when she saw my enthusiasm. It really is fun, she said. It's easy for me to set the table the night before. We're all together in the morning before school and work. And the kids really love to start the day in a special way. So what do you do exactly? I said, looking closely at the table, the better to copy her ideas. I get some holiday placemats, flowers, things to decorate the table, nothing fancy. Some candy, some little gifts. She held up a pad of heart-shaped sticky notes. I'm going to do this myself, I told her. I'm going to copy you 100%. People exhibit a festive spirit in many ways, with special music, decorations, food, tattoos. My mother has glorious collections. Santa Clauses, bunnies, gaily painted birdhouses, and she also decorates to celebrate the seasons, with forsythia in the spring, sunflowers in the summer, squashes in the fall. My mother-in-law sets a beautiful table, complete with imaginative flower arrangements for every family occasion. My favorite? For my birthday one year, because I rarely eat dessert, she stuck my birthday candles in an array of vegetables. I enjoyed what they did, but I never wanted to do it myself. Because I always want to keep it simple, and I'm an underbuyer, I used to assume that I lacked a festive spirit. As always, however, it's a matter of being Gretchen. I don't like to shop, and I don't like buying short-lived flowers and plants, and I'm not good at making elaborate arrangements, but even I could handle placemats and a table decoration, and I always love to use food coloring. I could imagine serving an all-green breakfast for St. Patrick's Day or red, white, and blue for 4th of July. I could invent a holiday. Wig Day! Our conversation had fired my enthusiasm, but I'd never actually planned a holiday breakfast. An entire year had slipped by. Now I had my chance. Early in the morning on February 14th, before anyone else got up, I put out heart-shaped paper plates, cut toast into heart shapes, and covered the pieces with peanut butter that I dyed red, put heart decorations on the window, and scattered some heart-shaped candies around the table. Eliza got a big kick out of it, but Eleanor didn't seem too interested, except for the part about eating candy at breakfast. But when we got to school, she told the children and teachers excitedly about the special breakfast she'd had and described in detail everything that I'd done. It had made a bigger impression than I'd thought. I made a note on my calendar for the week of March 14th. Remember decorations for St. Patrick's Day. That would be my next chance to celebrate a holiday breakfast. This kind of festivity helps make time more memorable. School day breakfasts blur and disappear, but little celebrations make some days stand out. Also, the major holidays are a lot of work. For someone like me, it was gratifying to celebrate minor holidays in a very manageable way. I can choose the bigger life by thinking smaller. Jump. One of my most useful happiness-boosting strategies was my personal commandment to act the way I want to feel. Over and over, I saw that if I act in a loving way, I feel loving. If I act cheerful, I feel cheerful. One morning, as I waited outside the door of Eleanor's kindergarten class, I saw one mother give a little skip as she walked down the hallway, and I was struck by the exuberant charm of that unconscious gesture. My feet, by contrast, rarely left the ground. My exercise featured the stationary bike, the Stairmaster, yoga, and weight training. I walked everywhere. I almost never ran up the stairs or hopped over puddles. In an instant, I decided I needed more jumping in my life. To put a spring in my step, literally, I resolved to jump every day. The allure of jumping shines from the jump pictures of Philippe Halsman, the photographer responsible for more than 100 Life magazine covers. He asked people such as Richard Nixon, Marilyn Monroe, John Steinbeck, and the Duchess of Windsor to jump for their portraits, and it's exhilarating to look at these photographs. Every day, whenever the thought occurred to me, I gave some kind of jump. I jumped in a silly way to make my daughters laugh. I gave a little secret skip on my way to the drugstore. I hopped up and down in my office. I did jumping jacks after I woke up in the morning. I jumped down the last few stairs. The sheer goofiness of it always made me feel cheerier, and the energy of the gesture made me feel more energetic. Energy creates energy. Try acupuncture. When I was writing my biography of John Kennedy, I'd been struck by a remark that he made to his aide, Dave Powers. "So much depends on my actions," he said, "so I am seeing fewer people, simplifying my life, organizing it so that I am not always on the edge of irritability." I hadn't just been elected president, but I also often found myself on the edge of irritability, and I too wanted more tools for self-mastery. For years, various friends had told me about their experiences with acupuncture, but I'd never paid much attention. Although my neck gave me occasional trouble, I didn't have any problems with chronic pain, and I'd never had a particular reason to try it. However, I became intrigued one morning when a friend happened to mention how much she loved acupuncture. "Really? You go to an acupuncturist?" I asked, surprised. She's a very skeptical person generally, and not much interested in alternative medicine. Although acupuncture, or treatment by insertion of needles at specific points in the body, is now so widely practiced that it doesn't really qualify as alternative. "Yes, I've had really good results. I try to go once a week." "Why?" "Well, I started going because of my insomnia." "Right," I nodded. "It helped with the insomnia, but more than that, it makes me calmer. I have so much energy. My mind is always going a million miles an hour. I feel like I have to do three things at once. After acupuncture, I still have my natural energy, but I can take my time. I don't need to race around. I can sit and read a book. I'm less impulsive when I make decisions." "Does it hurt?" "It pinches for a second when the needle goes in, but that's it." "How many needles?" "Sometimes as few as 8. Last time I had about 25. It depends." "Do you really think it works?" "The first time I had acupuncture, I could feel something like an electric current pulsing around my body. Now I just generally feel better, more calm." "You know," I said, making up my mind in an instant, "I'd like to try it." "Let me know if you want the information," she said. Maybe acupuncture would be another tool for self-regulation. I imagined it as a human tune-up, a way to get adjusted and aligned for better performance. A few weeks later, I was heading up an elevator for my appointment. The waiting room was exactly as I'd pictured it, with chimes, a statue of the Buddha, a scroll, and one of those tabletop miniature Zen gardens on the coffee table. Also, somewhat incongruously, a metal scale like the one at my gym. I'd prepared for the visit by filling out an exceptionally long first-time visit form that covered everything from my eating habits to my family history to whether I had complaints such as feelings of heaviness or foggy thinking. From the questions asked, I inferred that many people came to acupuncture for help with infertility, digestive problems, muscle pain, or stress. I described my treatment goal as general wellness. After I'd handed in my form and moved to a treatment room, the acupuncturist's assistant took my blood pressure. This bit of standard Western medicine seemed out of place in a room dominated by 3 posters depicting the acupuncture points and a crystal suspended in the corner. The acupuncturist breezed in, a likable conversational guy, very preppy. He checked the pulses in my arms and legs, examined both sides of my tongue, then explained to me why, according to this theory of medicine, my liver and kidney function needed adjustment. I couldn't really follow his explanation. I was bracing myself for the needles. The assistant had confided to me that my acupuncturist's nickname was Butterfly Fingers, which was reassuring, and in fact, his actual sticking in of the needles was painless, except oddly at the top of my left ear. The needles looked very thin, light, and springy compared to other kinds of needles. I lost count after he'd inserted 13. We chatted as he worked, mostly about the weather. I felt odd, carrying on a conversation as I lay with needles poking straight out from my forehead, ears, and other places. The acupuncturist, naturally, took no notice. "I'd recommend an herbal supplement to help you along the lines we discussed," he said when he'd finished. "And you might consider Reiki and Shiatsu. We offer that in this office. Or, of course, you can go